You're listening to Building Bridges for Impact, a podcast series brought to you by SHIFT, the leading center of expertise on the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights. Each episode, we sit down with an expert that is influencing the conversation on how we can hardwire respect for people's rights in the way business gets done. Now, here's today's episode and your host, SHIFT President and co-founder, Caroline Rees.
Bob, welcome. Thank you for joining me for this conversation today.
Caroline, nice to see you and thanks for the opportunity.
You're a formidable academic, innovator, commentator when it comes to the role of business in society. And you were there at the founding of some of the key initiatives aimed at measuring and reporting companies' environmental and social performance. You've written many books, hundreds probably of articles around this subject. But one thing you've been talking and writing about lately is something called stakeholder capitalism. So for those listening to this conversation today who aren't familiar with this idea, how would you sum up stakeholder capitalism in a few words? And why are we starting to hear so much about it now?
So you've all probably heard about stakeholder capitalism, might be wondering what it is. It's really quite simple. It says that companies, if they're going to create long-term value for their shareholders, they obviously need to take account of, you know, all the other stakeholders that are important to them. It's their employees, it's their suppliers, it's their customers, it's the communities in which they operate. So I think as a lot of people know, I mean, traditionally, it's kind of been the Milton Friedman thesis that companies exist to make money for their shareholders as long as they're not violating any laws. And that's really the way companies have been run for, you know, 50, 60 years. So it's a relatively recent social construct.
So it hasn't always been about shareholder primacy. So we have a longer history where maybe other stakeholders were part of the conversation as well. Is that right?
I mean, it's right. There's a wonderful book by my Oxford colleague, your alma mater, Caroline, a professor named Colin Mayer at the Said Business School at Oxford. It's called Prosperity, Better Business Makes the Greater Good. He looks at the corporation over thousands of years in different countries. And when you read his book, what you find is that this current social construct, and all of these things we're talking about are social constructs, is relatively recent. I mean, it was only at the turn of the 19th century that we had this notion that a corporation exists, has identity. What you had was this legal form that came about when the economy was very different, when companies weren't huge and had the kind of impacts that they have today. And then I think as things evolved and the capital markets evolved and we started getting reporting and regulations and the SEC and a lot of things I won't get into. But in the sweep of history, it hasn't always been that way. And I think what's important to note is the enormous size of companies today and the externalities that they're creating in the environment, both individually and collectively. And so when you've got a very different planet with resource constraints and lots of inequalities of various forms, you know, issues around human rights, which we'll talk about, I think we need to step back and say the corporate form that we've had maybe for the last 100 years, it could have been fit for purpose at that time, but there's no reason to assume that that same corporate form and all the regulations that go around it is the appropriate corporate form for today.
So what I hear you saying is that we've had this paradigm, this understanding for a while, but only for a while, that it's about money going to shareholders. The shareholders are the primary concern and the returns to the shareholders drive the way that business gets done. But now we're saying, hang on a minute, there are other people, there are other stakeholders in the mix.
I think what you see is there's a recognition that if companies aren't paying attention to other stakeholders, and hence the term stakeholder capitalism, you know, whether it's issues around the environment like climate change, whether it's social issues like income inequality, they're going to have a difficult time creating value for shareholders over the long term. So where I think it maybe doesn't go far enough is that there's the language about it, whether it's being put into practice efficiently, unclear. And then there's issues around kind of the corporate form, which maybe we can get into later, that gets us to rethink the basic legal structure under which companies operate today.
Who are we talking about when we refer to these stakeholders? Who's in the frame and why them?
Well, it's a good question because it's all pretty vague in a sense. I mean, even with shareholders, it's vague. Shareholders are not a single class. There's short-term and there's long-term and there's hedge funds and there's, you know, social impact funds. And so, you know, they're not a common class. I think when you get to stakeholders, typically the way people frame it is they'll say there's employees and there's customers and there's suppliers in the communities in which we operate.
Certainly, Bob, I mean, when we think about it from Shift's perspective, as we think, and you referred to that concept of human rights earlier, you know, we're often looking within those categories you referred to, employees and suppliers and communities. Where are the people who are most at risk? Most at risk from the ways business gets done, right? And it brings us back to that idea of ways business has been done that have been focused on pulling value and money up to the multinational and its investors, and perhaps away from the lowest paid workers in the workforce, or the workers in the supply chain, or the communities down at the level of a commodity on a farm around a mine or whatever. And that value distribution that has pulled all the value, all the money and wealth up to one end and left many of the most vulnerable workers and communities on the losing end, right, of this shareholder centric model. But that's a phenomenally difficult thing, right? You're thinking about a boardroom, a C-suite conversation, thousands of miles away very often from the realities of the effects of decisions that get made on poorer or more vulnerable communities. How do we bring those two realities closer together?
So look, it's a fundamental question. You need to have the corporate community, you need the incentives for the executives and the board members to be longer term. And you need the shareholders to be longer term as well. And one of the positive things is that that's beginning to happen. I mean, the people that trade, you know, kind of on the margins of setting the stock price. But if you look at the big pension funds and you look at the big asset managers, they're universal owners. They can't diversify away from system level risk. And they're saying, we want you to take a long-term view. I'll give you an example that came out of COVID-19. Companies made different choices. There's trade-offs. Do we believe in stakeholder capitalism or not? Okay, here's a trade-off. Am I going to maintain my dividends and I'm going to furlough employees and throw them off on the social safety net, lose human capital, lose the expertise that these people had, you know, they lose their jobs? Or am I going to cut my dividends so that I can keep the people? Companies made different choices. Some decided to maintain the dividends. I know investors that went to these companies and said, well, you know what? That was the wrong call. We're not looking for dividends for this quarter. You know, we were looking at you. We want to hold the stock forever. Bad call, company. You should have kept your people that are important to create value over the long term. So you made a short-term decision that just doesn't make any sense to us. So I think if the investment community is reflecting and reinforcing that they do have a long-term view and that the incentives for executives reflect that as well, it'll help us move in a very positive direction. And they're really two sides of the same coin.
So many company leaders instinctively and intuitively talk about our people are our greatest asset. And yet when it comes to measuring, they're measured as a cost, right? They're an expense.
But is that right? I mean, should we take the minimum wage? And that's one of my favorite examples. Is the starting point, you know, why don't you pay a living wage? That's then where you get right to the crux of sort of shareholder capitalism with a short-term focus and stakeholder capitalism, because companies can say, can come out two ways. I can say, if I pay a living wage, I'm going to be at a disadvantage to my competitors because my profit margins are going to go down because my labor costs are going to go up. And I have to make sure that I take care of my shareholders. Or you can say, look, you know, if I'm paying a living wage, you know, I'm going to have better trained, more motivated. There's going to be benefits, you know, and over the long term, that's going to be reflected. But let's take it even further and say, but what if that's not the case? You know, what if paying the living wage actually means that there's lower returns to shareholders, you know, in that particular company? Under a different corporate form, that could be okay. You know, and when you look at the big investors that have got this system level view, they can say, listen, I don't want a very profitable company that's creating externalities around carbon emissions or creating externalities in their supply chain. That's not good for me over the long term because it's contributing to this system level instability. Something's going to crack, right? And we're getting our arms around the environmental issues. There's science-based targets. You've got all these groups. How you get your arms around the human rights issues, you know, are there system boundaries? How do you measure the instabilities? You know, what's the data you need? You know, how do you peer deep into your supply chain? It's a very hard question and I don't have an answer to it. That's why I'm glad you're doing the work that you are.
Well, I mean, living wage is such a great example and we're in the midst of some fascinating work with the Capitals Coalition around this question. And so, you know, the ways that we've constructed our systems for measuring things seem to work exactly in the opposite direction from the rhetoric we use to talk about what we think is valuable. And the rhetoric and the ways of measuring things suddenly make no sense at all, right?
I think that's what we're really talking about. You know, how do you enforce corporate accountability? And in this particular dimension, around human rights, because there's a number of mechanisms now that we see, investor groups like Climate Action 100 Plus. I keep thinking, what would be the human rights analog to a Climate Action 100? And it's really hard because, you know, again, we don't have the science-based targets. We're not sure what the metrics are. What should the standards be? But I think you need to elevate the social dimension. And I think under the kind of branding or the labeling or the rhetoric of human rights is a good one. But then we need to be more sophisticated about figuring out what are the levers, what are the techniques, what are the requests that need to be made to make it more tangible. Because it's, who can be against human rights? Sure, I support human rights. Great. Well, if you do, it means this and this and this and this and that.
So, I mean, clearly we need to be measuring some different things from what we currently measure. And we need to measure things differently as well in a number of regards, as you're suggesting there. And those levers of change that you point to, I mean, one of the ones, and it brings us, I think, back, you know, to the heart of this change in the mode of capitalism. One of the things that we've been looking at in our work quite a lot is leadership and governance, right? Because we want to get to outcomes that are better for people and planet, but they can be very situation specific, and therefore your metrics get very on the ground and quite distinct. But there are some things around leadership and governance that are much more common across organizations. The way that the organization is wired to be alert to or to completely overlook the way that decisions affect people. And that governance piece feels really important here, but it seems to speak to boards that may be quite differently constituted with quite different sets of expertise from what perhaps your average board has today, right? If we're going to be capable of thinking about these other stakeholders in informed ways and understanding the connectivity from business to business. Is that right? I mean, how do we need to think about the board of the future if a stakeholder capitalism is going to work?
I got to tell you, you know, the weak link in the chain, at least for me right now, is the board of directors. I think CEOs are kind of beginning to get it within the constraints, but if their board doesn't and their board is saying, well, we want to make sure that this next quarter is going to look pretty good, you know, then the CEO's hands are going to be tied. And so somehow we need to change the mindset of boards of directors. I mean, there's still a prevailing ideology, and it's more people my age, you know, in boards, that the ideology is shareholder maximization. And that's not actually what the law says. Right. The law says the board is responsible to the corporation. It's a little bit nuanced in, you know, the United States, the corporation and the shareholders. But there's no country in the world that says the fiduciary duty of the board is to make sure that shareholders, you know, make as much money as possible, indifferent to the interests of other stakeholders, indifferent to the long-term interests of the company.
So the room is there to act differently and think differently. It just needs to be used.
Yes, even under the C Corp structure.
Yeah. Bob, wrap us out here. If this is the transition we need to see towards a stakeholder-oriented form of capitalism that includes shareholders but brings in the people most vulnerable to harm, the planet and the future of all our societies in a planet that can survive and thrive, you've named a number of things that need to alter. What would your top two or three prescriptions be to bring about that shift towards a stakeholder capitalism that we want to see?
You know, on the human rights side, on the social side, if I had to just say one thing off the top of my head, I'd say commit to pay a living wage, you know, and that there's going to be a living wage that's paid throughout your supply chain. And it's going to be arguments about how you define it and what it means. But you've got to start somewhere. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And it's a concept people can understand. So, you know, let's get away from, okay, the law says, you know, here's the minimum wage. If we're really serious about stakeholder capitalism, living wage doesn't seem like it's a whole lot to ask for, right? So people can feed their families. So I'd say one thing would be commit to a living wage. And if you sort of had that as a movement, just like companies are committing to net zero by 2050, if you had commitments that we're going to be paying a living wage and throughout our supply chains, then I think that would be a good step. I guess the second thing would be, I really like what Leo's done with his idea that the compensation committee, the board, should be thinking about compensation more generally throughout the company. And then I guess the third thing, and this is something that I've been pitching for a while and, you know, admittedly with not much success, I think every company should have their board of directors publish a 2-page statement of purpose of the company. So if we've all agreed, you know, with the business roundtable that there's stakeholder capitalism, and purpose of the company isn't just to generate money for shareholders, I don't think it's a big ask for the board of directors, everyone sign it, that there's going to be, you know, a statement of purpose, you know, that they can put it if they're a US company in their proxy statement. And I think in the statement of purpose, you know, is the perfect place for the board to take positions on. Do they think climate change is real? And do they think the company has a responsibility for addressing that? You know, and what is the company's positions on human rights? I mean, the board's not going to get into tactics and metrics and things, but I think if you could have in a statement of purpose by the board of directors, you know, then that sets the platform for companies. But the board of directors makes very clear in a company specific statement of purpose that human rights are important. And, you know, that they take that into account throughout the entire supply chain, as well as, you know, the products that they're offering to their customers. Is it just rhetoric? Yes, but then it's something that's been put out into the public domain. And then management has to think about how they implement it. And then you can have shareholders and NGOs and other people have the conversation and then hold companies accountable for doing it.
Yeah, fantastic. So that grounding in the purpose that may start as rhetoric, but is a foundation for accountability, some clear target setting, net zero, and maybe other areas that you could take to your shareholders and get them behind as well. And then that living wage and compensation piece, so catalytic. As we know, when parents can earn a living wage, it's more likely their children can go to school, that health improves. Let's do that. Let's continue the conversation. But for now, thank you so much for joining me in this perusal of stakeholder capitalism and what it could and should mean if we get it right. Bob, thanks so much for a rich conversation. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for the opportunity, Caroline. Good to see you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Building Bridges for Impact. If you liked what you heard, check out our other episodes at shiftproject.org/buildingbridges. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shift Project to stay up to date on all our latest projects. Together, we're building a community that is putting the rights of people at the center of how business gets done.